Okay, good evening. It's very good to see all of you here this evening. Going ahead and getting started with our Bible study on the book of Judges. The book of Judges is a very interesting book in that it covers a period of Israel's history that is sort of the settlement period. You could compare this period in American history to sort of the pioneer days, the settling of the Old West. There are several things we will look at. One of the things you have is the book of, is a chronology of the book of Judges. There are a couple of benchmark dates that we use to establish this chronology, and I wouldn't vouch for it being accurate to the exact year. Perhaps it is, perhaps it's 2 or 3 years off, but it is certainly a close approximation. We know certain things in terms of being able to date events in Scripture. One of the key benchmark verses is 1 Kings 6:1. It came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel. This was the date of the beginning of the temple. So the fourth year of King Solomon is equivalent to the 480th year after the Exodus. Enables us to figure back. We know from Scripture that David reigned 40 years, Saul reigned 40 years. That plus the fourth year of Solomon would give us 84 years, taking us back to the beginning of the monarchy. And then, of course, the 40 years in the wilderness. So we would learn from that that this the period of the judges, or let's say from the entrance into the land, would be you'd take 124 away from 480, to get 356. From that would be from the entrance into the land until the time of King Saul. There is a date in the book of Judges that dates the beginning of Jephthah's reign. We'll notice that in a little bit, that the time when Jephthah became judge was 300 years after the entrance into the land. And that is a date that is given a little later in the book of Judges. We'll comment on it as we get to it. That tells us, of course, that from the entrance into the land under Joshua down until the time of Jephthah, that there were 300 years. What we find as we go through the book of Judges, because of some time parameters that are set, is that certain of the judges overlapped, and you'll notice that here on the chart toward the end. The book of Judges is, in many ways, a story of the up and down that is there. It as we read in Judges chapter 2, that in verse 7, that the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. Joshua died, he was 110, and we find that verse 11, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They served Baal, forsook the Lord God, and they followed after other gods. So, verse 14, the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. He delivered them into the hands of the spoilers. And then we find that the Lord raised up judges, verse 16, who delivered them. They wouldn't listen, verse 17, to the judge, went whoring after other gods, and departed from God's commandments. And so, verse 18, when the Lord raised up a judge, he was with the judge, delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge, for it repented the Lord because of their groanings by reason of them that oppressed them and vexed them. When the judge was dead, they returned and corrupted themselves. In verse 20, the anger of the Lord was hot against them. And he said in verse 21, this is a key, I will not henceforth drive out any from before them of the nations which Joshua left when he died, that through them I may prove Israel whether they will keep the ways of the Lord to walk therein as their fathers did keep it or not. Therefore, the Lord left those nations without driving them out hastily, neither delivered he them into the hand of Joshua. You see, as you go through the story of the book of Judges, we have this up and down, up and down, up and down. This situation where the when a faithful leader was there, Israel would be relatively on track. When the faithful leader died, Israel very quickly got off the track. Then they had trouble. God sent difficulties upon them to sort of wake them up. Then they began to cry out to God, and God would give them a little relief, and it didn't take long. They just, the whole story of Judges, up and down, up and down. Now, God makes a point, inspired the record to be made, that there was a reason why all of these pagan nations were not quickly driven out. God has inevitably set before His people choices. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't make any difference what you do or that one choice is as good as another. All choices are not created equal by any means. God tells us that one choice leads to life and another choice leads to death. He tells us which choice to make. But He nevertheless insists that we not simply choose the right by default because that's all there is. There may be a period of time like that to educate people, but sooner or later, there's always an alternative that is presented, which they're clearly told to reject, but they have the option. God put two trees in the garden. You know, it's not that the devil sneaked in and planted one while God wasn't looking. There were two trees in the garden. God allowed there to be two trees. He told Adam and Eve which one to leave alone. He told Israel coming into the promised land, He said, I set before you life and death, good and evil, choose life. Here, seeing the attitude, God allowed some of these pagan nations to stay there. Why? To prove Israel, verse 22 of chapter 2, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord to walk therein or not. You see, He told them what to do. But He left some of these people around. And so what was Israel going to do? Well, you know the story as it goes on in Judges 3, verse 4, they were to prove Israel by them, to know whether they would hearken unto the commandments of the Lord, which He commanded. And so Israel dwelt among them. In verse 6, they took their daughters to be their wives, gave their daughters to their sons, served their gods. Children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Eternal, their God. So that was of course, the story. If we go back to Judges chapter 1, we notice that something about the Canaanites. In verse 27, it says, neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of Bethshean and her towns or some of these other places. Verse 28, it came to pass when Israel was strong, they put the Canaanites to tribute and did not utterly drive them out. You see, God told them to drive them out. But they came in, and when they had the strength to do it, they decided, you see, being greedy, decided, you know, why don't we make slaves of them? Why don't we make servants of them? We'll put them under tribute and we will make them serve us. Well, that went along for a while, but you know, of course, what happened is sooner or later, Israel was in the decline and then the Canaanites had the upper hand and then they didn't pay tribute anymore. God said, get them out of the land. Make a separation. They didn't do that. Dwelt there with them, absorbed some of their pagan culture. When they had the upper hand and had strength, they put them under tribute. In other words, they used their own human reasoning as opposed to doing what God said. And the result, of course, was they had nothing but trouble and headaches for years, for generations. And so the result was, you see, that God made it plain that they were going to bring consequences. He told them, you know, that they would get entangled with idolatry, and they would allow the things that God had revealed to them to be watered down, to be abandoned because of the influence of these other people. Well, the we've seen here in chapter 2, beginning in verse 16, 17, 18, and 19, sort of a summary of the whole book of Judges. Israel, God gave them a judge. He delivered them. They didn't listen, went after other gods, got in trouble. God had mercy on them, sent them another judge. The judge was dead. They corrupted themselves, and over and over. That's just the cycle. It's like a broken record going through the book of Judges. You know, there are lessons for us to learn as we look at that and realize that rarely do things stay on track for more than a generation. You know, things come along and there are lessons to be learned. People become comfortable. They take things for granted. They begin to water down, begin to be attracted and enticed by the world. We've seen it in our day. You know, we have not at this point gone into physical captivity, but we've seen it in the church. The breakup of organizations and things that have happened. A similar situation. Now, one of the things to read in conjunction with the book of Judges, as we go through the book of Judges and you realize how totally off track things are, it is, I think, very helpful to read the book of Ruth in conjunction with the book of Judges, because Ruth starts out in Ruth 1:1 that in the days when the judges ruled. And so what you find there is a contrast. You find that even when the nation was off track, when all sorts of things were happening that were totally wrong, and when God was sending plagues and problems, there were individuals who in their own personal lives obeyed God and sought God, and God watched over and took care of. There were individuals. You see, none of us can use the excuse that, well, what everybody else is doing. That doesn't wash. The book of Ruth clearly shows that God expects each of us as individuals to serve Him regardless of what is happening round about. Now, we notice here in Judges 3 that as it begins, that the nations were left to prove Israel, to put Israel to the test, to see whether they would trust God and follow Him. Well, as we come on down through the story, we find that once Joshua and the elders that outlived him were dead, Israel very quickly got off the track, and within about 7 years, if you notice the chart on the chronology of Judges, within about 7 years of the death of Joshua, the problems with this invasion from Mesopotamia occurred. And the children of Israel, chapter 3, verse 8, served Cushan-Rishathaim for 8 years. And they began to really cry out to God. And God sent a deliverer, Othniel, who was Caleb's nephew. If you remember correctly, of course, Caleb and Joshua were the only two faithful spies. This was Caleb's nephew, son of his younger brother. And verse 10, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. He judged Israel and went out to war. And He prevailed against the Mesopotamians, and the land had rest 40 years. And Othniel died. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, because they had done evil in his sight. And he gathered together unto him the children of Ammon and Amalek, and went and smote Israel and possessed the city of palm trees. And the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. Now, we find here this recurrent phrase, rest. God gave them rest. We went into that a little bit previously when we went through the book of Joshua as to how when God brought them into the promised land, that they had been wandering 4 years. And God gave them rest. And that is used in the Psalms, and it's used particularly in Hebrews 3 and 4 as a type pointing toward the millennial rest, of which the Sabbath is a weekly reminder. If you've been wandering and on the road for 40 years, and every little while you have to pick up your tent, pack it up, move on, maybe for a day, maybe for how long, then you put it down. You've been doing this repetitively over a period of 40 years. If you can settle down in one spot and stay there, that's awfully good. That's rest. God gave them rest. But one of the things we find is that rest is contingent upon obedience. You see, when they began to disobey, God disrupted their rest. He allowed these Canaanites to come in and some of these other nations and to oppress them and to deal with them in a way that greatly disturbed their rest. And then God would raise up a faithful judge. And this cycle went on through. They were given rest 40 years in the days of Othniel. But after he died, they got off the track. Now, we're introduced to Eglon, who was the Moabite king. And God raised up a man by the name of Ehud, a Benjamite. He was left-handed, and that plays a role in the story. Ehud, you know, when you read this, you're reading sort of like the Wild Frontier. They didn't have gunfights in the street. They... because they didn't have guns. They had other things. And that's sort of what this was. Ehud made a dagger, a two-edged dagger. It was about 2 feet long, or maybe not quite 2 feet, foot and a half, between 18 and 24 inches. And he girded it under his raiment upon his right thigh. That way he could reach it with his left hand easily. And he brought a present to Eglon, king of Moab. And when he came in there, he said he had told the king he had something special for him, and managed to get everybody else out of the room and got up there close to the king and said, "I have a secret." So Eglon sent everybody else out, and they closed the door, and Ehud came up there. Of course, Ehud's secret was he had a dagger in his belt, and the next thing you know, he had thrust it into... Eglon's belly, as it says in verse 21. And Eglon was a pretty hefty fella. He was, in fact, he was so fat that Ehud lost his dagger. He got it stuck in there, and he couldn't get it back out. We're told, as it says in verse 22, that the fat closed upon the blade, so he couldn't draw the dagger out of the body. So there went one dagger down the drain, but there went the king of Moab down the drain too. Well, Ehud went on out the back way through the porch and shut the doors, locked them. Well, the servants waited out there, and they waited and waited until they got embarrassed, and they thought, well, you know, maybe he'd gone to the bathroom or something, and they waited and waited, and finally decided that they had to go in. So when they went in, well, they found him dead. And Ehud blew the trumpet in Mount Ephraim, and collected a group of people, and God delivered them. And they slew of the Moabites about 10,000 men. And Moab, verse 30, was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. And then we find that after Ehud was dead, chapter 4, verse 1, guess what? Surprise. The children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord when Ehud was dead. So the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. And The captain of his host was Sisera. Well, the children of Israel cried to the Lord. He oppressed mightily the children of Israel for 20 years. Now, there was a woman mentioned in verse 4 by the name of Deborah. She was a prophetess, and she was she dwelt under the palm tree, under the palm tree of Deborah, there in verse 5, between Ramah and Bethel. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment, and God gave her special revelation. Now, as this 20 years of oppression was drawing to a close, Deborah sent and called Barak and told him to take 10,000 men from Naphtali and Zebulun, and told him to go out and attack the Canaanites and that God would deliver them. Now, Barak was not a particularly bold, adventuresome type. Barak's response, verse 8, was, "If you'll go with me, then I'll go up. But if you won't go with me, I'm not going." Barak was not one of the great warriors of history. He was somebody that wanted Deborah to sort of hold him by the hand. He was scared to go up there. He said, "If you'll go with me, I'll go." Well, Deborah, as we're told in chapter 5, verse 7, talked about the inhabitants of the villages ceased. They ceased in Israel until that I, Deborah, arose. I arose a mother in Israel. You know, the state of the nation was such that it was like they were like a bunch of little kids. You know, here they were, little boys, needing mama to take them by the hand and lead them down the road. And it was really, in a sense, to the shame of the nation, of the men, that God said, you know, you need mama to come and just sort of take you by the hand. That's the way you're acting. That's the level of maturity and the level of leadership that was there. So God raised up Deborah to be a mother in Israel. That was her function. And as she told Barak to go down there, you know, she'd had a revelation from God that Barak was to lead the army. Well, Barak was scared to go. And he said, "I won't go unless you go with me." So she said, "I'll go." Verse 9 of chapter 4, "But the journey you're going to take is not going to be for your honor." All right, you know, if you need mama to come and hold you by the hand, I'll go, but you're not going to get any credit out of it. The Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. You know, you're not going to have any great glory out of this battle. If you want the women to take you down there and you need me to hold your hand, I'll go. But so you come on through the story, and we find that God overthrew the Canaanites. Sisera, who was the Canaanite general, fled, verse 17. And he fled to the wrong place. He fled to the tent. He fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Now, I don't know how well Heber slept at night. After this event, I think if I were him, I'd have wanted to make sure I was on good terms with my wife when I went to bed, because Jael here, Sisera fled and came there, and Jael went out to meet him, and she said, "Come on in here, I'll hide you." And verse 18, he turned into her tent, and she covered him with a mantle, and he said, "Give me something to drink, a little water." And so she opened a bottle of milk and gave him drink. The Jewish commentary brings out it was buttermilk, actually, that she gave him. But anyway, she gave him something to drink, covered him up, and he said, "Now you stand here and watch." Well, she let him go to sleep. In verse 21, then she took a nail, you know, one of these big tent pegs, and a hammer, and came softly to him and smote the nail into his temple and fastened it to the ground. He was fast asleep. He was dead before he knew what was going on. So Jael was a pretty rough person. You wouldn't want to get on her wrong side. That's why I said, I don't know how well Heber slept at night, you know, particularly after this event. But if I'd have been him, I think I'd have been a little on the nervous side. But anyway, she she polished off Sisera, the Canaanite general. And so, verse 23, God subdued on that day Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel prospered and prevailed against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed him. And then we have the song of Deborah, and how God had intervened, and the things that were there as so that chapter 5 is sort of a celebration of that. Well, guess what? When you get to chapter 6, verse 1, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. That's a big surprise. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against the Israelites. You see, the story, we're told here that Deborah and Barak continued. There was a period of 40 years here when righteous judgeship occurred. Verse 31 of Judges 5 says the land had rest 40 years after this victory by Deborah and Barak. Now, the children of Israel did evil, and they were delivered into the hands of the Midianites. And the Midianites prevailed against them. And really, these must have been terrorist raids, coming in and burning crops and looting the land and just terrorizing the people. Because we find that many of the children of Israel, chapter 6, verse 2, made dens in the mountains and caves and strongholds. So they were hiding in all sorts of spots. And the children of the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east came up. And they destroyed the increase of the earth, verse 4. They rustled the cattle, and they did all these things. And the end of verse 5 tells us they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished. So they came in and just looted and burned and destroyed and killed livestock and drove off livestock and burned crops, did everything they could. Well, guess what? The children of Israel cried unto the Lord because of the Midianites. And as we come on down to verse 11, we find that an angel came. And there was a man by the name of Gideon who was threshing wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. Now, normally, wheat was threshed in a large open area because you needed the breeze, the wind, to winnow the wheat, which was to separate the grain from the chaff. After they could pound on it, they could drive oxen around on it, they could do various things that would break the grain loose. But you had this. Then all this grain and chaff was all mixed up together. You had to sort it out. The grain is considerably heavier than the chaff, so when you would throw it up in the air, if you were particularly, they would usually use a sort of a flattened hilltop, either beaten earth or stone, and you'd normally have a breeze there during the time of year they would do that, and they would throw it up, and the breeze would blow. And the chaff, of course, is very light. It would float away. The grain would just fall right back down. So you keep throwing it up, and the chaff is going away. In some cases, they would use winnowing fans, using big palm fans and things of that sort, and produce a breeze that would blow the chaff away. Well, here is Gideon hiding down here behind a wine press to do his winnowing. So you can imagine what he's doing. He's got a little handful, you know, and he's sort of throwing it up and blowing on it. Well, he is spending a lot of time doing a very little bit of winnowing. But he's hiding because he's scared of these Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him, verse 12, and said, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." That sort of came as a surprise to Gideon. And Gideon said, if the Lord's with us, why has all this befallen us? What's happened to all these miracles? You know, we heard about hundreds of years ago when God brought our people out of Egypt, all these great miracles occurred. We hadn't seen any of those lately. And so Gideon, the angel told him, well, God's going to use you. Go in your might and deliver the children of Israel. And Gideon said, verse 15, how am I going to save Israel? My family's poor in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my father's house. And so the angel showed a miraculous sign here in terms of the sacrifice being miraculously consumed. And then Gideon was really scared. Verse 22, he said, oh no, I've seen an angel. I'm going to die. Well, the Lord told him, don't be scared. You're not going to die. And so then he was told, verse 25, take your father's young bullock and throw down the altar of Baal that your father has and cut down the grove and build an altar to the Lord and take this bullock and offer him for sacrifice. Well, Gideon did it, verse 27. But because he was afraid, he couldn't do it by day, so he did it by night. And, you know, Gideon was, he was wanting to be obedient, but he was not a very bold fellow. He decided, well, he'd do it at night, nobody would know. But, you know, word has a way of traveling. Things get around, and it wasn't too long before people put two and two together and figured out Gideon was the one that tore up the altar of Baal. And now they were mad. They wanted him brought out. They were going to kill him. And his father said, well, look, are you let Baal plead for himself. And so Gideon, verse 32, was nicknamed Jerubbaal, which meant let Baal plead. And so the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, verse 34, and he blew the trumpet, gathered army together, and then he needed a little more encouragement. So he asked God to work a miracle, if he would put a fleece of wool, verse 37, and dew was on the fleece only and dry on the earth, then he would know that God really wanted him to go and attack. So God did that. And then Gideon said, verse 39, he said, look, just to make sure, why don't we do the same thing again, but let's do it the reverse. Let it be dry on the fleece and wet on the ground. So God did that. So then Gideon got his army together, and he was going to go against the Midianites. And God told him, verse 2, you got too many men. Now, Gideon didn't think he had too many men. Now, Gideon was a little nervous about going out there to begin with, needed encouragement. So he had he had a sizable group here. He had about 30,000 men. And he called the people together and said, whoever's scared, go home. And so 22,000 left. And all he had was 10,000. So, you know, that's a way to lose an army in a hurry. This was, you know, just over two-thirds of his men left. Then God told him, he said, you know, you still got too many men. So he went through this, and where he finally wound up with 300 men. And then God worked, gave him a strategy in terms of what he was to do. And you find that the Midianites and all these people wound up slaying one another. And so God delivered Israel from the Midianites. Now, Gideon used... There had been some problems, you know. Ephraim was mad because they hadn't gotten invited down to be part of the army. And Gideon used a little tact and got out of that trouble. Now, on his way, when he was on his way down there, he came through Succoth and he asked for some food. And the princess of Succoth said, you know, now here these are Israelites, but they're sort of weighing both, you know, they're sort of playing the odds. And they said, we don't think you're going to win. Why should we help? So they weren't very patriotic, didn't have much loyalty. So they said, we're not going to give you anything. And Gideon said, when I get through with those Midianites, I'm going to come back and take care of you. So he went on back, and what you find out he did as he came back, that he got the leaders there of the elders of Succoth, and he gave them a whipping with some briars. This was a rough switch to get a whipping with. And we're told in the end of verse 16, he took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. So they learned. He taught them. And so we find that he began to exercise rulership. Now the people decided, well, they wanted him to be their king. Verse 22, they said, rule over us, you and your son and your son's sons. You've delivered us from the hands of Midian. And Gideon said, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. So, anyway, this was the case. And Gideon, the one thing he asked was some of the booty, Ishmaelites wore earrings. That was not something that Israelite men did, but we're told in the end of verse 24, they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. That was a custom that came out of Africa, and so the Ishmaelites practiced that. And Gideon said, I want you to give me those that gold. So they took those, and that was all melted down. And so we read about that, and Gideon took it. And time went on. Gideon ruled for a number of years, as we read in verse 28. The country was in quietness 40 years in the days of Gideon. There were evidently problems in Gideon's family, and so the children of Israel, when Gideon was dead, verse 33, turned again and went a whoring after Baal. And now we find in chapter 9, verse 1, that there was a problem. Gideon had a son by a concubine. This son was named Abimelech, and he went there to the man of Shechem and tried to have himself made king. In fact, he was responsible for killing virtually all of the other sons of Gideon. And you read about that here in Judges chapter 9. And finally, Abimelech died. He is killed here in the end of chapter 9. Now, this Gideon's death brings to an end the central administration of Israel under the judges. At that point, the nation sort of fractured into eastern and western and central areas. What we find that this will be apparent as we go on, and I'll show you in terms of the chronology in chapter 11. Chapter 10 tells us that after Abimelech, there rose to defend Israel Tola, and he dwelt in Shamir there in Mount Ephraim, and he judged Israel 23 years. And after him, there arose Jair, a Gileadite, and he judged Israel 22 years. And they were ruling sort of in the northern and central areas of the land. And talks about Jair. Now, verse 6 says, the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. They served Baal and Ashtaroth and the gods of Syria and the gods of Zidon, the gods of Moab, and Ammon, and the Philistines. Verse 7, the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. He sold them into the hand of the Philistines and into the hands of the children of Ammon. And that year they vexed and oppressed the children of Israel 18 years, all the children of Israel that were on the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is Gilead. The Ammonites were an enemy from the east. The Philistines were an enemy from the west. What we find is that when Gideon died, as the scripture tells us in Judges chapter 8, that as soon as Gideon was dead, Judges 8:33, the children of Israel went a-whoring after other gods. Now, Abimelech, his son, tried to establish himself, and he ruled for 3 years, and then was overthrown, and Tola and Jair maintained a semblance of order in the central portion. But there were problems. The Ammonites from the east and the Philistines from the west. It says these enemies were stirred up at the same time. You see, chapter 10, verse 7. He sold them in the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the Ammonites. Then we start going through the story of the Ammonites and how Jephthah was raised up to oppose the... he was a Gileadite. That was over in the east. And he was... raised up to fight with the Ammonites. The Ammonites oppressed Israel for 18 years, we're told in verse 8. And so the story of Jephthah is told. Now, in chapter 13, we pick up the story that Israel did evil and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. Now, you see, we saw back in chapter 10 and verse 7 that God delivered them into the hand of the Ammonites and the Philistines. So the story is told of the Ammonite oppression in the east, and then beginning in chapter 13, we read of the Philistine oppression in the west. And the Philistine problem continued on down to the days of Samuel. Here is a key in terms of chronology. The Ammonites were coming and were complaining about that Israel had taken land away from them. And they wanted it back. That was their excuse. Well, in Judges chapter 11, verse 26, here's the message Jephthah said, sent back to the Ammonites. He said, "While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and her towns and in Aroer, and her towns and all the cities that be along by the coast of Arnon, 300 years. Why didn't you come and recover them after all that time?" See, he says, we've had your territory, or this territory you're complaining about, we've had it for 300 years. Well, 300 years from the entrance into the land under Joshua, which is when Israel took this territory, 300 years, you see, brings us down on the chart. If you notice, 1403 is the entrance into the land under Joshua. 300 years, of course, brings you down to 1103. And the time when Jephthah became king. Or not, became judge. So, this was, Jephthah became judge after the 18 years of the Philistine Philistine oppression. See, the Philistine or the Ammonite oppression. This is 18 years after Gideon's death. As you go through and put the story together. Now, at the same time, the Philistines began their problem. Now, Jephthah was a rough character. He was sort of the Robin Hood of the day. We're told Jephthah was an illegitimate child, and he had been run out of town. His brothers didn't want him there. And so, verse 3 of chapter 11, he fled from his brethren, dwelt in the land of Tob, and he gathered vain men to Jephthah, you know, sort of a rough, rowdy crowd. And they went out with him. So, then when trouble came along, they decided they needed old Jephthah. He was a rough character, and they wanted him, "Come be our captain." Well, Jephthah, one of the things he's noted for is this very rash and foolish vow that he made, that he would present an offering, or would present to God the first thing that he saw when he came back from the battle. Well, the first thing he saw was his daughter. And the Bible is a little bit ambiguous in terms of what he did, though the indication may be, if you look at the lament for Jephthah's daughter, is not that she died, but that she never married and had children. Seems to be the emphasis here in the last few verses of Judges 11. Well, the Jephthah died, verse 7 of chapter 12. He judged Israel 6 years, and he died. And Ibzan judged for 7 years. And then Elon judged for 10 years, verse 11. And Abdon judged, and he judged 8 years, verse 14. So we find these short period of judges. This is on the east side. This would be primarily in the, let's say, in the northern and on the eastern side that these judges judged. Now, chapter 13 picks up the story again at the death of Gideon. And we find that God's delivered Israel into the hands of the Philistines. We pick up the birth of Samson, which was a miraculous event, and that evidently occurred right around the time God delivered Israel into the hands of the Philistines, that an angel appeared here to Manoah, who was a Danite, and he and his wife had not been able to have children, and he was told that his wife would now have a son, but rather this son was to be a Nazarite from his mother's womb, verses 4 and 5. That would involve these particular things. The child would be a Nazarite, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. So this story is told of the events surrounding Samson's birth. And Samson was born. God blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to move him. Now, chapter 14, we begin to learn a little bit about Samson. Samson was, on one hand, the strongest man in the Bible, and he was also the weakest man. He was weak in terms of moral character. He was weak when it came to women. And this is made evident as we go through the story. We find that as we will put the story together next time, we will find that there were two little babies born in Israel right around the same time. There were miraculous circumstances involving their birth. God supernaturally enabled the mothers to conceive. And in each case, the child was to be a Nazarite. As you put the story together, it is apparent that Samson and Samuel must have been born very close in proximity to one another. They were both born around the time of the beginning of the Philistine oppression. And if you remember, the Philistines oppressed for 40 years. The first 20 of those years, Samuel and Samson were growing up. The highlight 20 years into the Philistine oppression was that the Philistines and Israel fought a battle that resulted in the Philistine capture of the Ark. That was the time at which Eli died. And the Ark didn't stay with the Philistines too long, but we find from the statement in 1 Samuel that First Samuel 7, verse 2, that from the time that the Philistines captured the ark until they were overthrown was another 20 years. That's 1 Samuel 7, verse 2. Samuel and Samson were both born at the beginning of the Philistine oppression. 20 years into that, Samson began to judge Israel, the 20 years that he judged them. And there were two events that occurred at the end of the 40 years that overthrew the Philistines. Samson pulled down the temple and destroyed the leadership of the Philistines. Samuel rallied the people to a time of revival and then led the army down to defeat the Philistines and drive them out. And that was the end of the 40 years of the Philistines. When you line those two events up, Samuel and Samson were very close contemporaries and very much a study in contrasts. Now, chapter 14 tells us about Samson. He saw one of the Philistine women, and he wanted to marry her. Now, notice what his parents said in verse 3. His father and his mother said, "Is there never a woman among the daughters of your brethren or among your people? Did you go to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines?" So clearly, this was a repetitive thing for Samson. And notice Samson's retort. He said unto his father, into verse 3, "Get her for me, for she pleases me well." The Jewish commentary brings out that the literal translation here is, "She's right in my eyes." This is the expression that is used several times in the book of Judges. People did that which was right in their own eyes. Samson said, "I want her, get her for me." So you see his attitude and disrespect for his parents. As we come on down through the story, we find that Samson had... sort of a contest with some of these Philistines. He proposed a riddle and they couldn't solve it. And his wife, verse 16, wept before him, and she cried and moaned and nagged. And finally he told her the story, told her the riddle, and of course she promptly went and told the others. And Samson got mad and he left. And after a little while, his anger had cooled down, and so he came back to visit his wife and decided he'd go back and take her. But then turned out, she was living with another man. She'd moved in with somebody else. Now Samson was really mad. So in verse 4, he caught 300 foxes, took firebrands, turned tail to tail, put a firebrand between the midst of the two tails, and he set the brands on fire and turned it all loose. Now, you talk about pandemonium. You turn all these foxes loose, tied tail to tail with a firebrand between their tail, dragging along, and you can imagine what a mess you'd have. Well, it burned up the crops, and so Samson was doing this to be avenged of the Philistines. There were battles and there were difficulties, Samson, we're told in verse 20, judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. So his judgeship overlapped with the 20 years, actually the last 20 of the 40 years of Philistine oppression. Well, he went to Gaza, chapter 16, verse 1, and he saw a harlot, and he went into her. So Samson just sort of goes from one mess to the other. So he goes into this harlot, and people find out he's in town, and they're going to capture him the next day. So he gets up in the middle of the night and dislodges the gates of the city. Now, if you've ever seen pictures of city gates in ancient times, we're not talking about a little, gate on a picket fence. We're talking about a massive structure. And Samson carried the whole thing on his shoulders and brought it up there to the top of the hill. Well, a little while later, he met up a woman by the name of Delilah. She began to nag him and say, "Tell me, why are you so strong?" Samson made up this story and told her. And so guess what? She bound him. He told her that if he were bound with seven strips of bark that had never been dried, he would be weak. Well, she got this and she did it. So sure enough, he just snapped it like thread. And Delilah said, verse 10, "You've mocked me. You didn't tell me the truth." And so now he told her another tale. And guess what? She tried that. And then verse 13, she said, "You've mocked me. You've made up another story. You didn't tell me the truth." So he made up a third story. And guess what? She tried that too. And she told him, verse 15, you don't love me, you won't tell me. Now, you know, a person, you wouldn't think that, you know, somebody have to be Einstein to begin to put two and two together. Everything he's told her, she tried. But she keeps nagging, and Samson keeps hanging around. So finally, he tells her the truth. And guess what? She does that. She shaves his hair and his beard, which was the symbol of his Nazarite vow. Well, the Philistines came in and captured him, put his eyes out, took him to Gaza, and tied him up there to grind grain in the prison house, just like an animal, an ox. Now, time went by. You know, it's interesting. Samson was blind now. But as you read the story, you have to think maybe for the first time in his life, he really began to see. Had a lot of time walking around and around and around in a circle. Everything was dark before him. He must have looked back and contemplated what a wasted life he had had. Well, he began to pray and to seek God during this time. Time went by, and Samson was brought out of the prison house, and they were going to make a joke out of him. They brought him there into the temple. And Samson had himself placed where the two center pillars were right there where he could touch them. And the lords of the Philistines were there, and there was this great crowd. And Samson now, verse 28, called on God. He asked God to please intervene just one time. And so his prayer in verse 30, let me die with the Philistines. You know, I don't deserve to get out of this. I've wasted everything. But give me a chance to do what I should have done. So we're told in the end of verse 30 that the dead which he slew at his death were more than they which he slew in his life. He accomplished more in his life, in his death, than he had during his lifetime. He had judged Israel, in verse 31, judged Israel 20 years. Well, this broke the back of Philistine power. And if you put that together with the account in 1 Samuel, which we'll go into next time, we'll see how it fits together. Now, this really ends the chronological story flow of the book of Judges, down to the death of Samson, because this story really is picked up in 1 Samuel with the story of Samuel and now Samuel's judgeship and the aftermath of that. But what we have here in the last part is in chapter 17 and 18 that we have a story, an inset story, that occurred in the early days of the book of Judges. Very early on. We'll see how we know that a little bit later. There was a fellow from Mount Ephraim by the name of Micah, and he was sort of a sneaky, shifty fellow. He stole some money from his mother. And then she pronounced a curse, and he got scared and gave the money back. And oh, she thought he was a wonderful boy, and she was going to give some of it back to him now. And so Micah got religion, and he decided that she had some little idols made, and Micah, verse 5, had a house of gods, and he made an ephod and a teraphim and consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. So Micah now sets up this little chapel out back with all the little idols in it. In the meantime, this Levite was on his way down, and he stopped to spend the night. And Micah gets talking to him and finds out that the Levite is looking for a place. And so Micah says, verse 10, dwell with me. You can be to me a father and a priest, and I'll give you 10 shekels of silver every year and a suit of apparel and all the food you can eat. And the Levite went in. Now, you show me any place in the Bible when God called a prophet when God called someone to be his servant, that where the topic, what's the pay? You know, where did Elijah or John the Baptist or Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel or any of them say, how much does it pay? I got to know, what are the benefits on this job? Well, you notice here, this is the first thing they discussed. It's not, you know, what do you believe or what is, you know, it's what's the pay? I'll pay you. This is what I'll pay you. And the Levite said this is good. So he was content, verse 11, to dwell with the man. And notice what Micah said, verse 13. He says, now I know the Lord's going to do me good. I've got a Levite for my priest. Boy, I got the real genuine A1 thing. I got a Levite. You know, not just my boy trying to fill in anymore. Well, chapter 18 continues the story. In those days there was no king in Israel, and the tribe of Dan sought an inheritance to dwell in. And so the Danites sent this spy party, and they were coming up there, and they stopped off at this fellow's house, met up with a Levite, and they got to talking, and he sent them on their way. They went up, spied out the land, came back, and brought the main army. And so the whole bunch stops by the house of Micah, as it mentions in verse 13. And these fellows are telling, these spies telling the rest of the army, yeah, there's a priest over here, a Levite, and they got all these little idols. Boy, they're really religious folks here. So they turned in there, and these men of war, and they came up there to the chapel, verse 17, and began to cart the stuff out, taking out the little idols and the little pictures and all the stuff. And the priest saw them. And the priest said, what are you doing? Verse 18. And they said to him, hold your peace, lay your hand upon your mouth, and come with us. Be to us a father and a priest. Is it better to be a priest to the house of one man or a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel? And the priest's heart was glad. Boy, he'd gotten a promotion now. He had a bigger church. He was glad. So he turned and they turned and departed. And they were pretty good ways off. Micah found out, and he came running after them. And they told him, said, you better go back. You say anything else, and some of the fellows might get mad, and they might do you some damage. So Micah had to go back home. Now, they came up and conquered the city here of Laish and changed it to the city of Dan. And they set up the graven image. Now, notice who this priest was. We're not told that until we get to verse 30. Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses. This was Moses' grandson. Now, the King James, in most translations, will render this the son of Manasseh. But if you check it up in a commentary, what you find is that in the Hebrew text, the consonants were all that were written. And what was written in the Hebrew was M-S-H, which is the Moshe. The scribes were embarrassed about that here Moses' grandson was such a reprobate. So they inserted a little tiny N up above the line between the M and the S. And so the way it was printed was you could tell that M-S-H was the word, but the N was inserted above the line. And so when the scribes read it orally, they always read it Manasseh rather than Moses. That little tiny N up above the line was to remind them to read it as Manasseh. And this was their idea of trying to save Moses from embarrassment. Well, that was, you know, it just shows that these sorts of things happen. So we find that story. Now, chapter 19 tells another story of another Levite. What we find, of course, is that the Levites were seriously off the track. And so now we understand part of the reason that every man was doing what was right in his own eyes. Because we find out that you had Levites like Moses' grandson, which clearly shows that the story had to be set, see, at the beginning of the story of the Judges. Now we come up to this other Ephraim, this other Levite. Chapter 19, verse 1, came to pass in those days there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite. And he took a concubine, and she was a loose woman. She played the whore, verse 2. Finally ran away and went back to her father's house, and she was there several months. Then he decided he'd go get her, and so he came back there wanting to make up. And so you get a little bit of the moral tone. This is the state of things. So these are the priests and the Levites. This is the way they're conducting themselves. So why should we be surprised as to the state of the nation? Well, the story goes on that this poor woman is... this horrible event takes place where she is... We find that there is she is raped and the whole tribe of Benjamin is going to sort of cover up and support that. And the Levite wants he wants vengeance, and so he manages to send out this grisly summons to all the other tribes, and he brings up all the all Israel, and they come up and gather against the Benjamites and virtually destroy the whole tribe. Then they get to feeling bad about that, and they've taken a vow that they're not going to give their daughters to be wife to the children of Benjamin. So the Benjamites wind up being invited to sort of steal some women, which they do. Look at the mess. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did that was right in his own eyes. So this carries us on through the end of chapter 21. So we see these two events, these two stories, sort of tacked on to the book of Judges that tell of events that happened early on in the book of Judges, that tell of events involving two Levites. We see the moral tone for the nation. Again, this is the setting, the context against which the book of Ruth is set. You see, none of us can ever use other people's conduct and other people's behavior as an excuse to do less than obey God. Regardless of what other people are doing, is totally irrelevant. We find some horrible examples being set here. Horrible things happen. But what you find is there were individuals who quietly, in their own way, they tried to obey God. They did what they were supposed to do, and God blessed them and watched over them and took care of them. And Ruth, of course, became the ancestor of the Messiah. The great grandmother of King David. Now it's interesting when you look at that. Just one other thing on that contrast. Here was Israel who had the truth readily available and didn't appreciate it. They did not. They were not thankful and appreciative for the truth, and so they continually were enticed by what the world had. Here was Ruth who came out of the world. She had grown up in the Moabite culture. And she recognized something of value when she saw it, and she was prepared to forsake everything she had known to serve the God of Israel. You know, the irony is sometimes those to whom things come easily don't appreciate it, don't value it. Somebody else looking from the outside in says, you've got something more valuable than you can imagine. Really makes a contrast, and I think that a lesson that we should think about. The book of Ruth, of course, is traditionally read by the Jews at the time of Pentecost, and I think it's good for us to perhaps review it and to think about some of the lessons brought out here. You come all the way down to the end of the book of Judges, verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. That sums up why the book of Judges is the bloodiest, goriest book in the Bible. Because everybody did what they wanted to do. Everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. It was a time of violence. It was a time of chaos. It was a time when people were doing what they wanted to do. Sort of the time of the frontier, the time of the pioneers. And we find a very rough kind of a society. And yet even in the midst of that, there were those who aspired to a different kind of life and who lived a different kind of life. Well, anyway, this concludes the our study on the book of Judges. You can look here at more detail on the chronology of Judges to line up these events, and that will bring us down to the time of Saul and King David. So anyway, with that, we'll be concluded, and I'll pass out material for next Bible study.